Welcome to Lightning in a Bottle, a podcast that addresses the needs of business owners before, during, and after they sell their company. As a business owner, you owe it to yourself, your family, and your employees to know your options, to be informed, and to plan early. We hope you enjoy this program, and if you have any questions, feel free to drop us a line by visiting our team's website at www.ubs.com/ATX. This is your host, Josh Pottinger, and joining me is my longtime business partner, Jason Georgianis, and together we run ATX Wealth Partners, a private wealth management team here focused on being a trusted resource for business owners, entrepreneurs, and the professional advisors that surround them. Joining us today is a good friend and colleague of ours, Sarah Solomon. As a senior strategist with Family Advisory and Philanthropy Services, Sarah works with families on understanding money, values, and philanthropic intent in the context of family wealth. And the focus is placed on the dynamic overlap of five types of capital: human capital, intellectual, social, foundational, and financial capital. And her global team lies within the firm's ultra high net worth wealth management division, whose mission is to serve as a thought partner to us and to our exceptional client families on wealth transition, family governance, and philanthropy as they seek guidance in developing cohesive intergenerational strategies to perpetuate their legacy. Sarah's a veteran. She's been with UBS for the last 20 years, and she's served in a range of capacities, including assistant market head for private wealth management in Chicago, helping ultra high net worth clients and the advisors who serve them. Sarah earned the Family Firm Institute certificates in family wealth advising and family business advising, as well as the Chartered Advisor in Philanthropy from the American College of Financial Services. And she's a member of the Purposeful Planning Institute. So Sarah lives in Chicago with her husband and two daughters, and we're very excited to have her on the line today. So let's go ahead and get started. Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Hey, Sarah, how's it going?
Going great. You?
Good. Everything's okay. Thank you.
Sarah, yeah, thank you for hopping on the line with us today. We really, really do appreciate it. And, you know, Jason and I have been recording several of these podcasts and helping business owners kind of think through the process around, you know, getting prepared for an exit, going through the exit, and then obviously life afterwards. And so one of the things that Jason and I see time and time again is a lot of business owners are so wrapped up in the day-to-day business that you know, they don't really think about what life's going to be like afterwards. And sometimes that hits them like a ton of bricks. The Family Advisory Group is a group that we just love, absolutely love. I mean, this gets in, you know, this isn't the quantitative stuff. This is the qualitative stuff. Clients, when they sell a business, they've got enough money to buy the houses and the cars and the land and all that kind of stuff. And then it kind of moves into the, you know, leaving a legacy behind. So I wanted, if you don't mind, just kind of give us a little overview. You know, your group covers a lot of ground and covers it in a bespoke way per family client relationship under the circumstances. And so just kind of sum it up for us here. What do you and your team strive to provide clients each day?
That's such a great starting point. I do want to share the mission of our group first, but then I want to put it into context. The mission of the UBS Family Advisory and Philanthropy Services team is to be a thought partner to private wealth advisors like Josh and Jason and their clients to be intentional about their wealth transition, and philanthropic journey. Putting that into context, as you would expect, a global wealth management organization like ours spends roughly 90-95% of our effort and energy thinking about financial assets and how best to serve our clients, be it with estate planning, cash flow, asset allocation, portfolio construction, and the like. What I do as part of the Family Advisory and Philanthropy Services team is spend about 90-95% of my time working with advisors and clients on qualitative capitals. There's a tendency to think of balance sheets as dollars and cents, or assets, liabilities, and equity. And my definition of true family wealth is inclusive of the four qualitative capitals that Josh already mentioned: human, social, intellectual, and foundational capital, which could also be called spiritual capital. And how can we be mindful that a family's true wealth is comprised of its members? And so we need to take into consideration qualitative capitals.
That's great, Sarah. Yeah, I think you know, this is one of those areas where I think a lot of people outside the firm, or you know, just clients, don't realize that, you know, how important it is to think about it in a holistic way. And I mean, at least in my experience, I mean, Jason, and you know, I think you would agree, you know, most people think of teams like ours that just focus on the investment side, and really there's just so much more to the relationship. So, you know, in terms of like continuing to succeed here, for many, you know, the middle years of life elicit a time for reflection and potentially natural shifts in mindfulness around one's individual impact, their social and their family relationships. And so, you know, what are the challenges that arise amid wealth during this key phase in life, or as for in the context of a business owner, you know, as they kind of exit that company and they settle into that next phase of life, and maybe some practical suggestions for meeting these challenges? How do you help clients kind of reflect on these priorities and what really matters?
I love this question. And I first want to start with some vocabulary. There's a common phrase that just makes me cringe, not because it's bad, because I don't think it helps people reach their full potential and doesn't offer an open mindset. So that term to me is next generation. And it implies that you're waiting for something, when really, if we use the term rising, it means that we're growing, that we have a growth mindset. And so that's the baseline for how we think about continuing to succeed. It's rising into your next phase. And that could be people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, never too late. The second thing to think about is individuation. And to us, that means establishing your own sense of identity separate from the wealth, meaning we are who we are, not just what we have. So I think those two concepts are important: rising and individuation. Then in the context of post-business sale, I think it's important to reflect on what are your values and what is the age and stage and readiness of your family members who will also be affected by potential lifestyle changes or time and availability changes post-exit. For the business owner themselves, or the generation that was really in it from the beginning, they may view themselves or feel like an immigrant to wealth, you know, that it's a new language and they want to be intentional about what this next phase brings. However, depending upon the age and stage of other family members, it could be that the identity and values of kids in their early 20s is well established. That may not be the case for younger kids who have parents who have sold a business, and they may be natives to wealth. The lifestyle choices, given the access to and abundance of financial capital, may be part of the identity of younger kids. And what we try to keep in mind is that values are caught, not taught. There's a tendency in parenting, and I do this myself, where I want to short circuit the learning for my kids. And so what I say is important and what I do may not necessarily be the same thing. So we need to be mindful of the age and stage of our own selves and of our family members post-sale.
I love that, using those terms, immigrant and then native to wealth. And I think that is such a key, I guess, aspect to kind of understand, because I mean, we're working with a family right now that just had a very large exit. And, you know, with that exit comes a substantial amount of wealth. With that wealth comes a fair amount of complexity with the planning that was done in anticipation of that exit. And there's a lot of nervousness around doing the right thing and not making any big mistakes out there. And he's the one that made it, but he's got, you know, the next generation coming up, and it's going to be more of a, I guess, more of a natural thing for them. You know, they didn't spend 70 years working on this.
Yeah, you know, I just have to jump in here on that concept of mistakes. One of the key elements of families who flourish is remembering their younger self. And we all learn through mistakes. So this notion that we have to get it right, or our family members have to get it right when it comes to wealth, creates an expectation that doesn't provide learning opportunities. So mistakes are okay. I mean, hopefully they're not huge mistakes, however you define that. But it's like, say with philanthropy, you know, something that client families often become more intentional about post-sale of a business is philanthropy. We always want to meet clients where they are in the journey, in the wealth journey, in the philanthropic journey. And we learn by doing. It's not practicing to be perfect. It's practicing to make progress. I think that holds true for wealth and for philanthropy.
You know, both of you have just referenced something that sparks different thoughts. Like, for example, Josh, I know obviously who you're referring to in terms of selling a company, and commensurate with that, some angst enters the picture. I remember about a year ago, Josh and I were up in New York, and we were being interviewed for whatever it was at the time. And we referenced this particular situation. The client was, like Josh referenced, gearing up to exit. And I recall our last meeting at that point in our office here in Austin. You know, we were speaking about the prospect of all of a sudden becoming liquid for $100 to $150 million. And you would think that would elicit a very joyful response. but instead, it was striking. He instead, and it was visible, it was palpable, there was angst about what is next. And, you know, here it is. He nurtured this baby in the company, like Josh mentioned, for 20 plus years. His identity was so attached to the hip of this company, and the prospect of parting ways with it, because commensurate with the exit itself, was he would step back and no longer have an active role. And it was interesting because that was at that moment, it was more powerful. The prospect of not being attached to this company any longer on a day-to-day basis was more powerful than becoming liquid for over $100 million. It was fascinating to both of us. And then another thing that you mentioned, Sarah, and just circling back to how Josh teed up this conversation and what you touched upon also in terms of the five forms of capital being, you know, quantitative and a lot on the qualitative side. So often when discussing the preservation of family wealth, the instinct is to hone in on that quantitative side of the equation, the financial capital. But we've been doing this together for a while now. We've seen so many cases where if the qualitative side is not addressed comprehensively, and if it's not a well-oiled machine, it could really impair the ability to grow the financial capital going forward. So how do you and your team help measure the qualitative side of it? What processes can you help to put in place to really get clients honed in on addressing that, which in turn will help them grow the financial side of their balance sheet?
We've spent a lot of time thinking about how to make qualitative capitals measurable. I've referenced our definition of the family balance sheet, focusing on true family wealth, which is the summation of qualitative capitals and financial capital as a quantitative capital. We've written an article called The Family Balance Sheet. And what we do is go through what are these five capitals. Human capital, for example, is the individuals who make up the family. And each person's human capital includes their physical and emotional well-being, as well as each individual family member's ability to find meaningful work and establish a positive sense of personal identity. We go through a definition of each of the qualitative capitals, and then we outline ideas or suggestions to grow each of those capitals. So sticking with my example with human capital, a family could consider growing qualitative capitals by emphasizing the importance of the dignity of work to an individual's sense of self and helping each family member to find the work that most enhances each person's pursuit of happiness. Now, we've been talking about businesses here. So it may not be that every child wants to work in a business. So some kids may have different feelings about the business being sold. But basically, with human capital, it comes down to encouraging all family members, especially rising generation family members, to develop a strong sense of personal identity that's separate from the family's financial success. After we've gone through defining and suggesting activities to grow each of these qualitative capitals, then we go through an inventory where each family member, from their own perspective, can rate or rank whether they strongly disagree, somewhat disagree, are neutral, somewhat agree, or strongly agree on each of the categories or definitions within the qualitative capitals. What we do as a team is then aggregate those without revealing identity, because we're also very focused on affirming families and not having select negative bias. And then we can facilitate a conversation. What did we learn? What is your family really strong in? Where might there be opportunities for growth or more open conversations? So all of this to say, we try to take an ambiguous big concept and break it down into definition, suggested activities, and then a measurement that leads to conversation.
Along those lines, I think what you might be referencing is the case of a family business, and let's assume for a moment there are two children, and one is just so passionate about it, wants to see this thrive for the many decades to come, and perhaps another one, it would be just fine by her or him to see it sold and leave the family tomorrow. How do you navigate fairness versus equality outside of monetary consideration? Like, how do you navigate when there is such
fair versus equal?
Yeah, when there's a big difference between the mindset between the kids, however many there may be. I mean, that's got to be extraordinarily difficult.
It is, and it's a common challenge of parents. You know, they grapple with this. So first of all, in order to answer that question, I want to take a step back. There's a lot of emphasis placed on transfer of financial assets. And our view of how parents can arrive at what's right in their own mind as givers comes from a four-step process. The reason we suggest this four-step process is because we believe it's important for giving to have spirit, that it's more than a transfer of financial assets. The first step is for the givers to know thyself. Some questions to answer in order to come up with your answer to knowing yourself in the context of giving assets to family members or loved ones is, what is it you're looking to achieve with a gift to someone you care about? How does it reflect your values, or does it? And how does it bring you joy? After that, we need to think about understanding the recipient. Not every person within a sibling group is the same. And so givers need to take the time to reflect on their recipients, thinking about the age and stage of development. Each recipient's character, is it formed or is it still developing? What is your level of trust for this recipient? In a book that I read on this topic a couple of years ago, there's an analogy that stands out in my mind. Will this wealth, will this financial gift hit the recipient like a meteor from outer space? The next step is communication and control. And parents often ask, when should I start telling my kids about our wealth? The short answer is there's no one exact time, but in general, there seems to be a pervasive choice that parents wait too long and share too little with their kids. So our suggestion is that you consider communicating more rather than less, sooner rather than later. And then the fourth step as givers is to let go. It's natural to worry about giving your financial assets to loved ones. And we never know what the consequences are going to be. So we need to acknowledge the reality that we cannot control everything. The only thing that we can control is what we say, what we do, and how we respond to events, because life is all events.
I know that the firm is very excited and is passionate about financial education and educating the rising generation. And so one thing that I saw coming across recently is something called the My Money Book Kit. And so I was wondering, Sarah, if you could kind of shed some light on the financial education efforts of the firm and maybe a little bit about this My Money Book Kit.
Sure, I'd be glad to. We believe that financial education is important, and that begins with personal finance as a bridge to future wealth management responsibilities. So starting with the end, individuals in the rising generation will some point in the future have wealth management responsibilities. Before they can feel empowered and knowledgeable about what are equities and what is fixed income, how do rates move, and what does this mean for my asset allocation, individuals need to have a working knowledge of basic personal finance concepts. We created an online education program beginning with grade school, going to high school, college, and after college to address this need. There are only a couple of states that require any type of personal finance curriculum in order to graduate college. So therefore, the responsibility falls onto parents. We want to be helpful to parents so that we can break this personal finance knowledge down into grade-based curriculum on topics like what are credit scores? Should I rent or should I buy? Why does security and privacy matter? Concepts like that. And to address the need for clients younger than, or kids of clients younger than grade school, we just created a My Money Book Kit. It includes a couple of things. First of all, it's geared toward kids ages 3+. I would say it's most relevant for kids ages 3 to 10. And we include a parent guide on teaching children about money. It talks about how money identities are formed by the age of 7 and how can we help our kids understand the sources of money, allowance, chores, gifts, etc. And then we break it down into giving, saving, and spending. A lot of our work at UBS is in a framework of liquidity, longevity, and legacy. We think that this give, save, spend mindset gives parents teachable moments, and it also starts young kids thinking about financial assets in those buckets. So we're really excited about My Money Book. And then we have a coloring book that goes along with it that becomes the learning opportunity for younger kids. The final thing in the package are 3 stickers, one for give, one for save, and one for spend, that can go on a mason jar and create those teachable moments in everyday life within a family.
Sarah, when you've run these family meetings, when you've spearheaded them, do you recall the youngest child you've had participate?
Yeah, it was a 14-year-old granddaughter. It was the parents of a blended family, 4 kids, and a grandchild from one of the sons, and she made the most profound statement in the entire family meeting when she challenged her dad and her grandfather if what they claim to be their values are actually how they live. It led to some really great conversations.
Fantastic. Along the same line, one question we get just about every time, and I'm sure you're queried with it often as well, is how much is the right number to leave to children? And it runs the gamut from nothing. I want to bounce the last check I write to everything. And sometimes you'll see parents live in such a way where their goal is to leave their children just that, as much as possible, to numbers in between. So if you look at a bell curve of the answers that you see executed amongst families, is there a sweet spot that you've determined over the years?
I'm going to have to give a non-answered answer because this really depends, and it's up to the wealth holders to back into this answer so that what they're giving aligns with their values and their financial plan. And so it starts, the way to answer this question is to start by answering for yourself, how much is enough for you? How much do you need to live? And then start to think about how much do you want to give to others, including charities, during your lifetime? And from there, how much do you want to leave to your heirs? What kind of standard of living do you want to set for yourself and those that you're going to be giving financial gifts to?
I'm left wordless.
Well, Sarah, this has been great. You know, obviously, we are living in some pretty strange times. You know, there's always going to be different levels of stress out there and stress on the families. And so, you know, having empathic communication and some governance is key. So any thoughts around that?
Yeah, you know, like you said, we're in a particularly unique time of stress for most every person and family, but stress is a part of life. And in order to put it into context of family wealth, we first have to start with our own self-awareness. If we feel like we're getting, you know, having an overreaction about something, taking a pause and being aware of your own self, then we need to be mindful of togetherness and separateness. I've touched on the concept of individuation as part of human capital. And so we need to think about how much time we're spending together and what do we do for our own self. You know, governance always matters, in our opinion. It doesn't need to be formal necessarily, but it's most helpful if it's an open conversation about how we're going to handle certain decisions or certain topics before we need to address them. So governance is about how do we make decisions, and stress has a tendency to be an amplifier, just like wealth can be an amplifier. To the extent we can think about what we want to do in advance of that happening, there's a tendency to have calmer heads and calmer minds prevail.
Mm-hmm. Picking up on the governance idea or topic there, you know, something that's encouraged is for families is an annual family meeting. You know, a chance for them to get together and kind of talk about these big ideas and the idea of having a family mission statement. I mean, we're all used to mission statements with companies and whatnot, but, you know, oftentimes when we bring up mission statements for a family, people kind of look at us a little bit funny. But, you know, maybe just kind of help us understand the definition of what a family mission statement is and, you know, kind of a high-level overview of a family meeting and how that should go and how, you know, maybe some advice for folks that maybe want to integrate that into their own families, no matter what level of wealth they have, really.
Let me answer both of your questions about what is a family mission statement and then what are family meetings and why do we think they're a good practice. First on what is a family mission statement. Family mission statements are some words that make sentences that capture the essence of the shared sense of purpose for your family. My personal opinion is that the words are not as relevant as the experience of crafting it together. We have an article on what family mission statements are, why they matter, how to use one, and then how to create one, where we go through 6 questions. I could show up to any meeting with any one of your clients and bring a family mission statement. It likely wouldn't even be a piece of paper that is brought from that room when the meeting is over. However, in the exercise of deciding as a family that you want to create a family mission statement so that there is a shared sense of purpose, if you begin with identifying your family's core values, then you talk about some reasons why you want to stay together and the traditions that you want to preserve and that are special to you, and then draft a family mission statement from there. it's much more likely that this family mission statement will mean something. And then it's important to dust it off. Don't just leave it on a shelf. Read it maybe before Thanksgiving or at your annual family meeting. Which leads me to family meetings. We believe that family meetings are a good practice for all families because they're about sharing with and learning from each other. We think of family meetings as a spectrum, not only informing other family members about important topics and updates, but an opportunity to educate and engage and evolve and grow together, taking interest in each person's hopes and dreams. Family meetings to us are a good idea for all families once a year or so, because we can find out what's on everybody's mind. We can work toward those goals and clarifying. And it's a great opportunity for open communication and air preparation through education, which matter most to successful wealth transition.
Do you see family mission statements redrafted from time to time?
We do, especially when, you know, you were asking me before, what's the youngest kid I've seen in a family meeting? If kids in a certain family don't start joining the meeting until they're 18 or 21, a family may review it and get the input of the new members who are joining, or review it with married-ins. Maybe the kids are at the age where they're now getting married and the parents want to include married-ins in the annual family meeting. I've seen families decide to add on to family mission statements during those times of transition within families.
Very well.
Sarah, thank you so much here. We enjoyed hearing your perspective and some context around some of these terms that some folks may not be familiar with, and kind of understanding the different phases of one's life and how wealth can impact them and their family. Getting a better understanding of a true balance sheet, which not only incorporates the quantitative side, but the qualitative side. I think that's really important for people to understand and to kind of think about the importance of financial education and getting these young, you know, children educated on some of the financial terminology that's being thrown around and getting them more comfortable and confident in talking about these issues. You know, incorporating stress and dealing with stress through solid empathic communication and having some, you know, some family governance in place through family meetings and having a mission statement. This is wonderful stuff. We just can't thank you enough. We always enjoy these conversations with you and your team. You do such a fantastic job and just provide so much value on this side. So you were generous with your time and we just thank you so much for that.
Thank you so much for including me and the group that I'm a part of. We love this work, and it's always a privilege to be in conversation with your clients on these topics.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. All right. This is Josh Pottinger and Jason Georgianis and Sarah. So remember this, know your options, be informed, and plan early. So until next time, we'll see you soon.